Chapter 15. Véronique flew to Luanda, the capital of Angola, on Emirates Airlines with a stop in Dubai. The flight was long, and in Luanda she took a short flight to Quito Cuanavale. There were two flights a week from Luanda to Quito Cuanavale, and the hospital was in a rural area, nearly 2 hours away by car. The Halo Trust was still working on clearing mines for the area and had made progress, but the surrounding area was not mine-free yet, with devastating effect on the local population, and some horrifying injuries as a result. She was met at the airport by a young man with the wide ivory smile, whose name was Joachim. He spoke surprisingly good English with a Portuguese accent. He walked with a limp, but was bright and friendly, and told her as they left the airport, "Dr. Dick saved my legs. I was 12 when my brother and I stepped on a mine. My brother was 9. He was killed. Dr. Dick saved my life," he said proudly, as they drove through the countryside past Quito Cuanavale. There were goats along the side of the road and chickens, children playing in the dirt, women in colourful clothes, penos, which were wrap-around batik garments, some with bright-coloured cloths around their heads or balancing baskets. Joachim was driving a battered old red Ford truck and wearing a colourful shirt and jeans. He had brought some bottled water for her. She had been travelling for 27 hours by then. She was hot and dusty when they arrived at a small compound with a tiny church, a large wooden building built by the locals with a sign outside that read St. Matthew's Hospital, and another large building that looked like a school. There was a group of nuns walking up the front steps in immaculate white nursing habits in contrast to all the bright colours around them. There were masses of bougainvillea and other flowers she didn't recognise, and the nuns were laughing as they turned to see who the new arrival was, just as Dr. Dennis walked out of the hospital. He had been watching for her from the office he used on the main floor. There were clusters of locals sitting on the ground, with small children and old people who were there to support the children they had brought to the hospital for treatment. Some of them were cooking. "Welcome," Dick Dennis called out to her, and hurried toward her. He was wearing a short white doctor's coat over a Hawaiian shirt, with jeans and hiking boots, and he hugged Véronique as soon as he reached her. She had travelled in jeans and hiking boots, too. The nuns came back down the steps of the building that looked like a school and were smiling as they came toward her. One was tall, heavy-set and older. Another looked barely older than Véronique and had an angelic face, and the other two were somewhere in their 30s, as closely as one could tell with the short white coifs of their habits. Their habits just reached their ankles, and they were wearing hiking boots, too. "Sister Anne," Dick Dennis said, introducing the older one, who beamed at Véronique. Sister Claire was the younger one, and the two in the middle were Sister Rita and Sister Charity. He had decided not to explain the circumstances of Véronique's stay before she came, and to let her do it, if she chose to. He didn't want to precede her with a tragic story if she didn't want to share it. All four nuns looked delighted to see her. "There are 12 of us here," Sister Anne explained, referring to the nuns. "You can figure out the names later. We have a room all ready for you." She pointed to the building they had just come from. "That's our monastery, our dormitory as we call it. The nurses live with us too, and we have some guest rooms for visitors. We're so happy you've come to visit." Véronique could hear that Sister Rita was French when she spoke to her. They were the happiest looking women she'd ever met. "I'll give you a tour of the hospital after you settle in," Dick Dennis promised. "You must be exhausted." But she didn't look it. She looked fresh and excited to be there. "I slept on the plane," she explained. Sister Claire took her bag from her, and they led her to the convent. There were people milling around in the common area between all the buildings. There were trees for shade and flowers everywhere. It looked like paradise to Véronique, and she was thrilled to be there. She felt like she was walking into a girls' school. There were more nuns in the halls and a few nurses in white uniforms. "We're one big happy family," Sister Claire explained. "There are 10 nurses as well as the 12 nuns. Most of the nurses are British. Sister Rita is French like you, and there are 2 Australians and an American. We do a lot of surgeries when the visiting doctors are here. They rotate in and out for a month or two at a time. Dr. Dennis is here 3 months of the year. It all rolls pretty smoothly." "Are you a nurse?" the young nun asked Véronique. "No, I'm just interested in what you do here. Dr. Dennis told me about it and invited me to come and see, so here I am," she said, feeling like the new girl at school. "We gave you a single room," Sister Charity volunteered. "Most of the nurses share, but they're on different shifts, so it works pretty well. We just finished our shift, so we came back to the monastery for our evening prayers before dinner." "How many children do you have in the hospital?" Veronique asked, as they walked to her room. "Usually around 80. We can handle close to 100 in an emergency. They bring us children from the surrounding areas and villages. Some of the minefields haven't been fully explored and cleaned up yet, and sometimes we get children who have lived with their injuries for a long time and were never properly treated." "That's a lot of children." Veronique looked impressed. "A lot of children need us here," Sister Anne said. "A lot of injuries and serious accidents, severed limbs, infections that go untreated, and then require amputations. We keep our doctors busy." They had reached her room by then. Sister Anne opened the door, and Veronique was surprised to see a big, airy room with a fan turning overhead on the ceiling. There was mosquito netting over the bed, which they called bed nets, and all the furniture was painted white. There were screens on the windows and gauzy curtains. She had expected a small dark cell, and instead everything was clean and bright, including the bed, which was freshly made for her and looked very inviting after her long trip. But she was determined to stay awake until bedtime, to get on their regular time. "There's a shower down the hall," Sister Charity explained. "Just put your name down on the schedule. You have priority since you're a guest," Sister Claire giggled. "The dining room and the kitchen are at the far end of the building. Breakfast is from 6 to 7 when the shift changes. Lunch is from 12 to 1 and dinner is at 6. We have local women who do the cooking, and the food is delicious, mostly local dishes. There's a cottage where the resident doctor lives, behind the hospital. Do you need anything?" she asked with wide eyes and a warm smile. "No, this all looks wonderful," she smiled at them. They were a perfect welcoming committee. "Are you hungry? Would you like something to eat?" one of the sisters asked her. "No, I'm fine." She was too tired to be hungry, and too excited to want to waste time on a meal. She washed her face and hands in the sink in the room after they left, brushed her hair, and went to find Dr. Dennis in the hospital. He was waiting for her in his office, and she could see his cottage from the window. "It's simple, but it all functions very efficiently. We get donations from organizations all around the world," he told her. "The nuns and the nurses are wonderful. Is your room all right?" "It's perfect," she smiled at him. "Thank you for inviting me. I didn't know what to expect." "I'll drive you out to the villages tomorrow and show you around. Would you like a tour of the hospital now?"
"I'd love it."
He looked so proud of the facility, and he seemed more at ease here than he did in his fancy New York office. There was an amazing contrast between the two. It was hard to believe he was comfortable in both and practiced in two such different environments. "I live to come out here," he said to her. "It's a whole different world and gives meaning to my life. You can really make a difference here, more so than for most of our patients in New York. When I first came here, the Civil War was still on and the casualties were brutal. That's how the minefield started." He took her through the wards then. There were 16 children in each ward, and 2 nuns and 2 nurses to care for them. The wards were designated according to how ill the children were. There was a surgical ward for children who had recently had surgery, with fewer children in it. Their families hovered around their beds, or sat on the floor, or sat on their beds and held them. "Their families are very much a part of their care. Some come from very far away, others are from nearby villages." You could see that it was a culture of family, as they huddled together. She observed as she walked through the wards with him that many of the children were missing limbs and only had stumps. More than half of the landmine injuries in Angola were children. They collected sticks for firewood in the fields, and the mines exploded. The children all got excited when they saw Dr. Dick, and he stopped to hug several of them and talk to them and their parents in Portuguese or Umbundu. He spoke both, and 2 other native dialects. It was a whole different experience for Veronique after the military hospital in Belgium and her recent surgeries in New York. This had a whole other flavour, which combined local traditions and culture with Western medicine.
"I bring in a lot of American medicines they can't get here. It's a big help, and we get shipments from Germany and France, too, and the United Kingdom. We're grateful for whatever we can get. We run it on a tight budget. We don't have a lot of funds, but we make it stretch. Most of the families do their own cooking on the grounds. Although we're primarily surgical, we give all of them vaccinations they'd never get otherwise. She could see how much he loved it, and how he thrived on the work he did there, and how much he cared about his patients. All the children waved and called him by name as he walked her through the Immaculate Hospital. They went back to his office after the tour, and she had noticed how neat and precise the place was, and the equipment looked surprisingly new and up to date. "We have a rotation of doctors from the United States, France, and the UK. I stay here longer than the others. Most of them can't take that much time off from their practices. But Philip is very good about it. He knows how much I love it here, and letting me do this was one of my conditions of opening the practice with him. If he needs me and gets too swamped, I can always fly back the way I did in March. But I like to be here as much as possible. I'll be here now till mid-June. Do you know how long you're staying?" "I haven't figured that out yet. I'd like to be useful while I'm here, as a volunteer in the hospital. It's the only service I can provide." "We can use all the help we can get," he said warmly. "The nurses and the nuns will let you know how you can help. Sometimes they just need you to sit with a child who's come out of surgery, if we're short-handed. Some of the children get injured by dangerous farm equipment. We have a full house most of the time. The nurses used to run the place themselves with a doctor who came through once a month. We've recruited a lot of volunteer medical staff since then. There's always a doctor on duty here now. We had some Australian docs here last year who were terrific." The feeling was very international, while respecting the African traditions and how they cared for their sick. The nurses spent a lot of time teaching parents to change dressings to avoid infection. By the time she left his office, it was almost 6 o'clock. He had more patients to see and post-op patients to check. Véronique wandered back to the dormitory and went to find the dining room, and when she did, it was a big room with long refectory tables and more fans circulating overhead. The smells from the kitchen were delicious. The nurses she had already met in the wards walked in as she was looking around and invited her to sit at their table. More nurses joined them a few minutes later, and within half an hour, all the tables were full with laughing, talking, chatting women. It looked and sounded like a girls' school for adults, only no one was glum or unhappy to be there. There was an atmosphere of real joy and pride about what they were doing, and it was contagious. Several of the nuns made a point of introducing Véronique to other nuns and nurses. They were all interested in where she was from and how she had heard about them, and asked how long she was staying. They were an open, friendly group of women, who all made her feel welcome. They had chicken with delicate spices to eat for dinner, cornmeal, plantain, and some vegetables she didn't recognize, but it all tasted delicious. After she had eaten, the trip caught up with her. She could hardly keep her eyes open as she headed to her room. She brushed her teeth, put on pajamas, and crawled under the mosquito netting. And before she could put her head on the pillow, after she turned out the light, she was instantly asleep. So far, she loved everything she'd seen and everyone she'd met at St. Matthew's. It felt like coming home. The next morning, after breakfast at 6, she took a quick shower according to the schedule and arrived at the hospital as Dr. Dennis was starting his rounds. He had two nurses with him, whom she hadn't met yet, and he introduced her. Both were British, Prudence and Felicity. She accompanied them to the wards and observed what they were doing. Many of the children were severely damaged after accidents, and several of them had disfigured faces, mostly due to the minefields. One little girl, who appeared to be about 4 or 5, cried when he checked her dressing. She had been in a mine explosion when walking to the river with her mother. She had deep scars on her face that looked similar to Véronique's. She smiled at the little girl and pointed to her own face. The little girl stared at her and stopped crying, and asked her mother in their dialect how the lady had hurt her face. Felicity translated it for Véronique, and Véronique answered without feeling self-conscious, possibly for the first time. "A big explosion," she said to the mother, gesticulating with her arms to show how big it was, and said, "boom," loudly to go with it. The little girl laughed when she did, and let Dr. Dennis examine her. She watched Véronique with interest the entire time. The little girl smiled again when they left her, looked at Véronique and said, "boom," herself, and pointed to Véronique, and they all laughed. "Yes, boom," Véronique said again, and pointed to her face. Then the child said something to her mother,
which Felicity translated again. "She says you are very pretty," Felicity said with a smile.
"Thank you," Veronique answered her. "You are very pretty too," she said, pointing to the little girl and smiling, as Felicity translated again.
The little girl giggled and hid her face in her pillow. They moved on and Veronique was still smiling. The nurses didn't comment on the exchange or ask further details about the scars on Veronique's face. Boom seemed to cover it.
When they finished the doctor's rounds, he took Veronique out to the car he drove while he was there. All the doctors used it.
"I thought I'd give you a look at the nearby villages." He spoke the local dialects well enough to converse with the patients easily and occasionally used a translator for difficult cases, so he got all the information he needed accurately. He was deeply committed to the people in the area and the goals of the Halo Trust to make Angola mine-free in the future. Their name stood for Hazardous Area Life Support Organization, and he'd known many of the young people in the villages since they were born. They followed a deeply rutted road and stopped at a village about 10 miles away with a lot of mud huts and a few shaky-looking small wooden buildings. Several of the residents recognized him and greeted him warmly as they walked around. A stream ran alongside the town where women were washing clothes and carrying vessels of water and baskets on their heads. Most of them wore sandals, many were barefoot. Their poverty was evident, but they were friendly and welcoming to Dick and Veronique. No one looked unfriendly or unhappy. A few were eating, and there were cows nearby. "The cows belong to the chief," he said to her, "to show that he is the richest man in the village." As they got in the car to leave, a man ran up to them and tried to hand a young goat to Dick. He kept bowing and thanking the doctor in Kikongo, and Dick pointed to the car to show he couldn't take the goat with him, and the donor accepted it back in good humour. "We give them free services," he explained to her, "but that's not how they like to do things, so they bring us melons and chickens, an occasional goat or a young pig. They like to pay their debts. They're honourable people. I always tell Philip about it and wonder what would happen if our patients gave us pigs or goats in exchange for Botox shots. That could be interesting." She laughed, thinking of how luxurious their office was. A pig running around the office would definitely be entertaining. They visited several other villages that were similar, Chiumbo and Lioma, and then looped back to the hospital on another rutted old road. She had seen numerous injured children during their drive. There were many of them, and she could see why their hospital treated so many patients on an ongoing basis. "The roads get washed out sometimes during the rainy season. It's harder to get to them then, and for them to come to us. We have an old truck with four-wheel drive, but it's not reliable. We need so many things here. We have to prioritize very carefully. The medical equipment and supplies come first." She could see a need for many kinds of equipment. He said the hospital existed on donations of the material they needed and medical supplies, but whatever they got was never enough, and their available funds were limited. It was after lunchtime by the time they got back to the hospital, and she went to get something to eat in the kitchen, and then to clean up after the drive over the rough roads. She took off her hiking boots and jeans, which were all dusty. Prudence, one of the English nurses, dropped by to say hello while she was changing and saw the scars on her legs. "Was that Boom, too?" They both smiled, thinking of the little girl with the scars on her face in the ward that morning. Veronique nodded and put on fresh jeans. "Yes, it was. It was a big Boom." "Military?" she asked her. She had been an army nurse for 5 years before she left the military and came to Africa to St. Matthew's, recruited by a doctor she knew who volunteered there. "Brussels Airport a year ago," Veronique said simply. "Shit," Prudence said, making a face. "The world is a crazy place these days. I used to see injuries like that when I was an army nurse and something went wrong on manoeuvres."
She had recognised the shrapnel wounds.
"I'm okay now," Veronique said, and meant it.
"What did you do before that, and before you came to Africa?" she asked, curious about her. She looked familiar.
"I was a model before the Boom," she said with a smile, and Prudence stared at her.
"Oh my God, Veronique Vincent! I saw every magazine you were ever in. You were my idol. I dyed my hair the colour of yours once. It looked terrible on me. That really is rotten luck. I wondered why I hadn't seen you in a year. I thought maybe you had a baby and took a year off. No, I took a year off after the boom, in a military hospital in Brussels. I'm trying to figure out the rest now. Will you go back to modelling? She looked anxious for her. Not with this. She pointed to her face. It looks better than it did, but it won't go away. So here I am. It sounds crazy, but I like it here, she said, smiling at Prudence. It is crazy, but we all do. That's why we stay. They need the help so badly. You go to bed at night knowing you've made a difference. I didn't feel that way in the army, or in a hospital in London afterward. Our doctors at St. Matthew's do a great job. It makes you proud to work here, although we don't have much to work with. We wing it a lot. I can see why you love it, Véronique said as they walked toward the dining room together. I hope you stay for a while. We can always use a spare pair of hands. That's why I'm here. They walked back to the hospital together, and Véronique went to volunteer her services to the nurses in the wards. They put her to work bringing trays of bandages while they changed dressings. She was all too familiar with what they used. She had seen it all in Belgium. After that, she helped make beds and coloured with crayons with two little girls. Her little friend from the morning waved at her across the ward and shouted, "Boom!" and then laughed uproariously, and Véronique laughed too. By the end of the day, she didn't know how she would have described what she'd done all day, mostly menial tasks, making things easier for the nuns and nurses. But the day went by, and many days like it. She rapidly settled into a routine of making herself available to all of them. She was the only non-medical volunteer around for the moment, and everyone was grateful for her help, her willingness, and her good humour. She was happy there. She felt as though she had found a niche and she belonged. Dr. Dennis observed her and crossed her in the halls frequently. She looked happy and at ease. The discomforts and primitive conditions didn't bother her, and she got along with everyone. She had made friends among the nuns and nurses. The children loved her. She had never thought she was good with children, nor was particularly interested in them. But here, it was different. She liked being around them and helping wherever she could. She felt comfortable in her own skin for the first time in a year. She was in the right place at the right time. Even 6 months before would have been too soon. She wasn't ready then, but she was now. She felt competent, useful, and connected. She'd been there for a month when she asked Dick Dennis if anyone had ever made a film here showing what they did and the children they cared for. It could help them raise money. He thought about it for a minute. There was a film of Princess Diana when she came out there, but that was a long time ago. No one here has ever had the expertise to do that, the time, the interest, the funds, or the connections. Would that be helpful to you? Véronique asked him. Of course. It's hard describing what it's like here. It's so foreign to people back home. They really don't understand and can't visualize it. She reminded him about the French TV documentary she'd been part of, about the victims and survivors of Zaventem. It was on French television, but you could send copies of a show like that to fundraise elsewhere if they were to do something like it here. Do you want me to call the producer? I'd love it. We can use all the publicity we can get to raise interest in Europe or the States. I'll call the producer, she promised, and did the next day. Olivier Berger, the producer of the Zaventem show, was intrigued by her suggestion to come and do a documentary in Angola to show the hospital and the patients and the villagers they served, and the eclectic international medical staff, some of whom were even French. And the issue of still active landmines was an important one. I'm committed for the rest of the month, he said, but if I get the go-ahead, we could come out with a crew in early June. Would that work for you? I'd have to ask. I'm just a visitor here. A volunteer. I know the doctor who's running it right now. He's here for 3 months a year. He's American, but they rotate British and French doctors too. I'll check it out here with my bosses and get back to you. They might like it. We're trying to do more of these real-life documentaries, and they can't all be tragedies. This might be a very interesting story, and the children made it upbeat and very poignant. I think you'll be impressed, she told him, and told Dick Dennis about the call, and he thanked her.
Olivier called her back a week later. They love it. They gave me permission to go ahead and do it with a small crew. How do I set it up? She had him call Dick Dennis, and they organized everything. The French crew was coming on the 1st of June, and Dick would still be there then. Véronique was pleased that it had worked. They were going to put St. Matthew's Hospital on the map. They needed help so desperately, and it was a wonderful feeling doing whatever she could, for all the right reasons. Chapter 16. A week after Véronique had spoken to Olivier Berger about a documentary about St. Matthew's, a British journalist, Patrick Weston, showed up on his own. He was a friend of one of the other doctors on the rotation, a British doctor, and he had come to write an article about the work they were doing there. He spoke to Dick Dennis, who liked him and was impressed by his credentials. He had written for some very prestigious publications. After talking to him, Dick gave him carte blanche to look around. He was going to take some photographs to go with the story. He was a freelancer and planned to sell the piece when he got back to London. He was young and personable and seemed very serious. He had gone to Oxford and was 34 years old. He had tousled sandy blonde hair and blue eyes and looked very British. He interviewed several of the nuns and most of the nurses as well as Dick. They gave him one of the guest rooms in the dormitory. He was very unobtrusive and got some wonderful shots of the nuns laughing, the nurses working, the children in the wards and their families, and he talked to Dick Dennis at length about the medical side of the story. It was several days before he got around to Véronique. She had already heard that he had gone to Oxford. His credentials were excellent, and he'd published some articles in the States as well. Véronique was sitting in the shade for a few minutes after a morning spent in the ward, and he came to sit down next to her. He smiled when he sat down and glanced at her. "I keep wanting to catch a word with you, but you never seem to stop. You're busy every time I look, holding a child or consoling a mother or making a bed. Are you a nurse?" Unlike the others, she didn't wear a uniform. "No, I'm just here as a friend." "You're French." He heard her accent and had assumed she was American or British, like most of the others. She nodded. "My father was American," she added proudly. "What brought you here?" There was something about her that intrigued him, and he hadn't figured out what. He kept her distance, although she was friendly, but guarded. "Dr. Dennis? I met him in New York, and he told me about it. It sounded interesting, so I came to see for myself." In the meantime, she had gotten passionate about a mind-free world, too. "Just like that?" She nodded with a mysterious smile. He had noticed the scars, but didn't ask her about it. He was very polite. "Yes, just like that," she confirmed. "Are you a medical person of some kind, if not a nurse?" He couldn't peg her. "No, I like the sound of what they're doing for these children. They do wonderful work. I've been here for more than a month, and I'm amazed every day. I've gotten interested in projects that people dedicate themselves to make a serious difference in the world." "That's noble of you." He smiled at her. There was something about her face that seemed familiar. "Why do I get the feeling that I've seen you somewhere?" "I must look like someone you know," she said coolly. "Not that I can think of. I don't meet women who look like you every day, Véronique," he said, and she looked embarrassed. "A wanted poster in the post office, perhaps?" she teased him. He laughed. "Why, have you been in prison?" "Not lately." He smiled at her answer. She was playing with him, and he suspected there was something behind it. He had a good nose for people, and she wasn't giving him answers. "Are you here incognito?" he teased her back. "Not at all." "Well, you're definitely a hard worker," he complimented her. "I love being here. I'd only been to Johannesburg before." "For work?" She nodded. She noticed that there was something sad about his eyes, as though something bad had happened to him. It was a look she understood, and it aroused her interest about him. "It's healing being here," he said, and she nodded and stood up. She agreed with him, but felt she'd said enough. "It's time for lunch," she said, and he stood up too. He watched her move ahead of him up the steps of the dormitory, and it was driving him crazy. He knew he had seen her somewhere before. He sat down next to Prudence in the dining hall, and Véronique sat down with the nuns. Prudence was flirting mildly with Patrick. She had a boyfriend in London, but she hadn't seen him in months. They were going to meet in Zimbabwe in August. She noticed Patrick staring at Véronique as she chatted with the nuns, and he said something to Prudence about it. "I don't know why, but I have the feeling I've seen her somewhere before." Prudence didn't answer for a minute and nodded. "You and the entire world," she said in a low voice, and then said, even more softly, "Does the name Véronique Vincent ring any bells?" He looked startled and stared at her. "The model!" He glanced back at Véronique then, and there it was. It clicked. Oh, good Lord! He could see the right side of her face as he stared at her from the distance, and the scars in all their glory. What happened? A car accident ended it? He thought she must have gone through a windshield to have scars like that. Prudence was serious when she answered. Something a lot worse. What could be worse than that? You'll have to ask her about it. It's not my secret to tell. So he hadn't been wrong when he guessed that she was there incognito. There was something mysterious about her, as though she was hiding something. He went to his room after lunch and Googled her. He got a million of her modelling pictures, one after the other, looking more spectacular in each one. Then the recent documentary on French television came up. He clicked the link and watched the beginning of it. He spoke enough French to understand it all. Then he knew the story. She obviously didn't want to talk about it, or she would have told him. But she wasn't hiding it either if she had been the main interviewer on the TV show. He got the feeling that she'd be upset if he asked. His heart ached as he listened to the stories, and then he came to the part where she explained her part in it and what had happened. He felt as though he had opened a Pandora's box and he shouldn't have. But it explained why she was here in a remote part of Africa, obviously looking for some new meaning to life after what had happened. He felt overwhelmed with sorrow for her. Living with the scars she had and losing a major career couldn't have been easy for her. A career that had obviously defined her, since it was all about her looks. She had said on the show that she had lost her mother in the blast, and a friend who was with them. He didn't approach her again until late that afternoon, when he found her sitting on the steps of the dormitory before dinner, wearing a big straw hat to shield her from the late afternoon sun. Her wearing it made it look glamorous. "I like your hat," he said, and meant it. "Thank you." She smiled up at him. He didn't know how to broach the subject and tell her he knew who she was. It sounded offensive, as though he was prying, and he didn't want to upset her. "Would you let me take a photograph of you for my article?" He'd taken pictures of everyone else, so it wasn't an odd request. "No," she said simply and firmly. "Why not?" he said boldly. "Why do you think? I don't like having my photograph taken." She thought it should have been obvious to him. "The left side of your face is perfect. I could take you in profile with the Angolan landscape behind you." "That would be cheating," she said, frowning at him. "No, it wouldn't." "Yes, it would. That's not how I look anymore." "The scars don't make a difference. You're still incredibly beautiful," he said solemnly, impressed by her honesty and her courage. "Thank you for saying so, but I don't think so." "Then you're wrong. The scars aren't you or all that's left of you. They were added to you. They didn't replace you. They don't cancel out how beautiful you are." "Thank you." She decided to be honest with him, to some extent. She looked him in the eye and it struck her again how sad his eyes were. "I don't want to be an object of pity or look like a freak." "There's nothing pitiful about you. You're here. You're in Angola. You're helping people, making a huge difference, as you put it. You're not sitting home and crying or brooding. That's admirable, not pitiful. I'd say you have the upper hand. You're a strong woman. If you weren't, you wouldn't be here. This isn't exactly the Ritz in Paris." She laughed. "You don't know how I got the scars." He could tell that she didn't like to talk about it.
No, I don't, he said, not liking the fact that he did and was lying to her. He liked her, and he didn't want to lie to her. No, that's not true, he corrected himself, and she was surprised. I googled you when I figured out who you are. He didn't want to rat out Prudence and say that she had told. So I do know. You're alive, Veronique, alive enough to be here and doing good work. The bad guys didn't win. You did. And I'll tell you something that I don't usually tell people either. I was in Paris at the Bataclan a year ago last November. My wife wanted to go to the concert. I hate that kind of music, and I went for her because it was in Paris. She was shot and died in my arms. We'd been married for 6 months. She was a fantastic woman, everything I ever dreamed of, and I would give anything to have her back, with 1,000 scars or no arms and legs, instead of having lost her. These attacks are savage. They don't just kill people, they kill people inside even if they survive, like you and me. Don't let them do that to you. Don't let them win. They killed her and they destroyed my life. Fuck the scars, Veronique. You're incredibly beautiful, even with the scars. You're doing the right thing being here. You don't need to hide that side of your face or even owe people an explanation for it, and surely not an apology. You are still beautiful, and you will be until your teeth fall out and you go bald. She laughed, and so did he. Why should I go bald? Isn't this enough? She looked incensed, or pretended to be. Well, eventually you'll be toothless and bald like the rest of us. Until then, you are still the most gorgeous woman on the planet, scars and all, and you are certainly not pitiful. She stared at him for a moment, stood up, and put her hands on her hips. Fine. Go ahead. Take my picture. He couldn't believe she'd said it. She was ordering him to. Like that, with you scowling at me? You look like you're going to kick me. I will not take your picture. You called me bald and toothless. She appeared to be outraged, and he laughed at her. I did not. I said you will be bald and toothless. I did not say you already are. Well, I'm not, so take my picture. And then her voice softened, and she grew serious. And I'm sorry about your wife, she said gently. So am I. She was fantastic. Not as beautiful as you, but no one is. She was a great woman, and I loved her. She was full of courage, like you. She sensed it was true. She was half Italian and half English, fire and ice. She was an incredibly talented journalist, far better than I am. I write junk compared to her. She wanted to write a novel, and she would have written a great one. We came from two different worlds. I came from a stuffy, pompous family of upper-class intellectual snobs. Her father owned a trattoria in Venice. She had none of the prejudices I grew up with, and she turned me into a human being. And then she was gone, and nothing made sense anymore. Why did I survive and she didn't? She was so much better than I am. He sounded as though he meant it. I ask myself that question every day about my mother and the friend I was with. Do you have kids? She asked him, and he looked like he was going to cry. No. She was pregnant. We just found out. It's hard to understand the meaning of life after something like that. Why it happened. Why you were there. Why they killed her and not me. They didn't even shoot me. They killed her and I walked out without a scratch. I've been trying to make my peace with that for 18 months, and I can't. You never will. I haven't been able to make sense of it either. Why my mother and my friend died and I didn't. Blind luck, maybe. Destiny. You just have to keep going. That's why I'm here. Now, are you going to take my picture or not? I used to get a lot of money for having my picture taken, and I'm doing it for free for you, so don't waste it. As she said it, he grinned and picked up his camera and took a photo of her head-on, scolding him, with both sides of her face showing, the old and the new, the smooth and the scarred, with the big floppy hat.
She was surprised when he took it.
"That's a terrible picture," she complained.
"No, it's not. It's a great one. And it wasn't cheating. I got both sides of your face, the old and the new, your funny hat, and you were giving me hell. Don't worry, I won't use it. That one's for me. I'm going to frame it. It's perfect. Can I say in the article that you were working here as a volunteer? I won't if you don't want me to." She thought about it for a minute, and then nodded.
"I guess there's no harm in that, as long as you don't run that picture."
She smiled at him, and they headed up the stairs towards dinner.
"You're complicated," she said to him.
"So are you," he said, and she laughed.
"I guess we have a right to be," she said more gently.
"I think we do." He sat next to her at dinner, and they had an intelligent conversation about a variety of subjects and a nice time together. It seemed odd meeting here, but it felt as though it was meant to be, given their experiences.
"You know, I've never been that open with anyone before about it," he said about what he'd told her. She was easy to talk to and listened well. He could tell she was a compassionate person.
"Neither have I. I suppose we have that in common." They both knew what it was like to go to hell and back and try to make sense of your life afterward. They were both still working on it. She had survivor guilt too, about Cyril and her mother. It was obvious that he was riddled with it over his wife.
"How long are you going to stay here?" he asked her.
"I don't know. Until I want to go back to Paris. Maybe until I feel good about my life again. I have nothing to go back for. And I want to do some good and put some love back in the world instead of all that hate. You've been there. You know."
"Yes, I do. I suppose we survived for a reason. I just don't know what that is yet," he said.
"Neither do I," she admitted. "I feel like I'm supposed to do something important now. I just don't know what it is. That's why I came here. I wanted to see what they were doing at St. Matthew's. It's very impressive, and I'm happy here," she said simply.
"I think they're doing very good work."
"I think you're pretty impressive too, Miss Vincent," he said, smiling at her. "And I think you're a terrible photographer. I hope you're a better writer," she said tartly, and he laughed. "I'll send you the article and you can decide for yourself." He was smiling and didn't look so sad.
"Thank you,"
she smiled at him. "They're going to shoot a documentary here in a couple of weeks for French TV.
That'll be good for the people here. It'll validate them for fundraising," he confirmed.
"I thought so too. I'd like to help them. They all work so hard." He nodded. He was going to write a glowing article about St. Matthew's for just that reason. It was a labour of love and helped so many people, even those who worked here. He walked her to her room after dinner, and they had breakfast together the next morning when they arrived in the dining room at the same time. They chatted a few other times, and 2 days later he left. He had other places to go in Africa and other articles to write on spec. She said goodbye to him and wished him luck. They both had a hard road ahead of them to recover from what they'd been through. She was feeling better, but she could tell that he was still struggling. She had seen it in his eyes. He promised again to send her the article when it came out, and then he left and drove away. He was flying out in a day or two. She spent the next 2 weeks helping Dick to get everything ready for the French TV production group. She thought of Patrick Weston a few times and assumed she'd never see him again. They were fellow survivors passing in the night. There had been a connection, but opportunity and geography were against them. She didn't give it more thought than that. He was an interesting person and seemed like a nice man, and she hoped he would recover one day from all he'd lost. It was the best they could do now, with the hands fate had dealt them.
Chapter 17. When Olivia Berger and the French television production company arrived, it turned St. Matthew's upside down for a while. They followed all of them everywhere with their cameras, into the wards, the operating room, into the convent, and to the nearby villages. They interviewed all of them about what they were doing there, why they had come, why they stayed. They wanted the viewers to know everything about the people working there and what they were doing for the children of Angola,
with the limited material and resources they had on hand, and the challenges they were facing, with active mines still in the ground. They interviewed Dick Dennis extensively, and Véronique briefly, since she played the smallest role there, and she was newly arrived. She said how much it meant to her to be there, and how it had changed her life after the attack in Brussels. She said it was the first thing that had given new meaning to her life. And knowing what they had done before, Véronique was sure that they would make a beautiful show out of it, and it would help everyone at St. Matthew's. She and Dick talked about it before he left, after the TV people had gone back to Paris. He thanked her for making it happen. He was leaving in 2 days and hated to go home. His heart was in Africa, with the children who needed his help. "How long do you think you'll stay?" he asked her. It touched him that her time there meant so much to her. It had done for her what he hoped it would, and brought her back to life, an even more purposeful life than she'd had before, with deeper meaning. "I'll stay until I'm ready to go back to Paris," she said quietly. "I'm not yet. I have no purpose there anymore, no reason to go back for now." He nodded. He had understood that. She was healing here in Angola, and he was glad he had suggested she come. The next doctor in the rotation had already arrived that day. Dick was handing over the relay to him and filling him in on all their patients. He was another plastic surgeon from London. "I won't be back here again until January," he said to Véronique before he left. "Maybe you'll still be here then." "Maybe," she said vaguely. "I have to go back sometime. I can't decide when yet." She hadn't told him that she wanted to make a large donation to the hospital, and she was going to. She had already sent Chip an email about it. He asked her how she was doing, and she said she was fine. "You did more to heal me than anyone so far," she said to Dick, "by bringing me here." "That's what I was hoping when I suggested it," he smiled at her. "Your face is looking good, too. I'll tell Philip." Most of all, she had learned to live with it. She hadn't even covered it with much makeup when she was on TV. What Doug had said for months had finally sunk in, and what Patrick had said when she talked to him about it. He had sent Dick an email telling him that his article had sold to the London Sunday Times magazine and would be out in a few weeks. "Well, don't stay in Africa forever," Dick told her when he left. "Come to New York to visit." But she had even less there than in Paris. She had a place to live there. "Maybe I'll stay another month or two. I'm not ready to go back. I'd like to do what you do and come here a few months a year. I'd like to come on your rotation." "That's usually January through March, give or take a month." "I might spend Christmas here. I have nowhere to be for the holidays now. This would be a good way to spend it." He nodded. "You'll find your way again, Véronique," he assured her. "You already are. When everything falls apart like that and ends, you have to find a reason for living again. I think maybe you just did." "I'm not sure how great my reasons were before. It's kind of empty living off your beauty as the mainstay of your existence. I couldn't have done it forever. You don't think about things like that at 18 or 19, or even at 23, unless something big happens to make you reevaluate your life. You can get involved in a project like this one and really make a difference. Everyone loves having you here, and you helped us enormously with the television show. It will give us credibility when we ask for donations. That's all thanks to you." She was sad to see him go the next day, and so were the others. But the doctor who took his place was young and dynamic. He'd been spending a month at St. Matthew's for the past 2 years, and Véronique liked him. She thought of going back to Paris in July, but decided to wait until the end of the summer. She had nowhere to go on vacation, and no one to go with. She and her mother always went to the south of France every year, and she didn't want to go alone, or to the same place without her mother. The year before, she'd still been in the hospital in Brussels. The time she had spent there had begun to seem surreal to her now, as though it had happened to someone else, a person she didn't even know anymore. She had changed so much in the last 16 months. It took the time it took, and you couldn't control it. Angola was so beautiful. She loved it more every day. It had a kind of savage beauty, and the conditions there were hard. but the people had a gentleness and innocence that she loved. She tried to describe it to Doug in emails, but she couldn't. It spoke to her in ways that nothing ever had before. She had found herself there after being lost for a year. She felt as though she had returned from the grave, and she didn't want to lose that again when she went back to Paris. Her life had too little meaning there, too little substance. Her mother was the glue that had held her life together and gave it depth and meaning. And now she was gone, and there was nothing to replace it. Chip had emailed her and told her he was coming to Paris in September, and she wanted to be there to see him and show him around. So she thought she'd leave at the end of August. She would have been there for 4 months by then. She thought maybe it was long enough for now. She was playing with the children one night outside at sunset, and she looked up as a car drove into the compound. When it stopped, Patrick Weston got out. She was surprised to see him. He saw her right away and walked over to her with a confident look and a warm smile. "What are you doing here?" she asked him. "Well, hello to you too. I told you I'd send the article. I didn't have your address, so I brought it to you." She smiled at his answer as he took a clipping of the article out of his pocket and handed it to her. The child she'd been playing with went to find her mother, and Véronique sat down to read it. It was good and strong and very tight, and the message clear about the good work they were doing and the importance of ridding Angola and other countries of landmines once and for all. He mentioned seeing her there, working as a volunteer, and there were no pictures of her, just as he had promised. She was still wondering why he had come back. "How have you been?" he asked her. "I've been good, really good, busy here," she smiled at him. She looked peaceful and healthy, better than when he'd last seen her. So did he. "I've been rethinking my life and what matters to me now. I still haven't figured out a job," she said, as they watched the sunset together. "Even if my life magically went back to the way it was before, I don't think I could lead that life anymore. It was heady stuff and fun, exciting and flattering. But a whole existence spent on your looks isn't very fulfilling. My mother pointed that out to me, and I ignored her. At 18 and 19 it was fun, and I never questioned it." "Why would you? You were making a fortune as a top model. What girl wouldn't want that? It's every young girl's dream." "It's a pretty empty dream, though. I'm going back to Paris in a few weeks. I think I'll come back here for a month or two every year and volunteer. But I have to find a real job now, or I'm going to bore myself to death and everyone I know." She felt ready to see her old friends now. She felt whole again, more than ever before. St. Matthew's and the people she met there and the children had done that for her. "You didn't bore me when I met you," he said, watching her. "What kind of job?" "I don't know. Something in philanthropy, like finding other projects like this and giving them money or raising funds for them. My father left me some that I'd like to do something useful with, to honour him and my mother. I think they'd like that." She had said as much to Chip, and he thought it was a good idea. He had told her she could start a foundation in both their names. "What about you? What have you been up to?" She was trying to seem casual about it. She was glad to see him. "Same as you, trying to figure things out." He looked better than when she'd last seen him, and his eyes didn't look so sad. "I have this crazy idea that if I survived, there was a reason for it. I don't know what that is yet, but I know it's there somewhere. Maybe I should write a book about the November attacks in Paris, or terrorism in general, and how pervasive that is. I lost a wife and unborn child. I don't want that forgotten about them or any of the victims. I want people to remember her and how wonderful she was. She was a writer, so I think she'd like that. I feel like we have an obligation to pay back as survivors. It's not just good enough to live through it, whether the scars are inside or out, but it's important to do something like what you're doing here. And if you survive, you have to crawl your way back. I've been doing that for 20 months, and you for almost as long. All I've figured out is that life is about more than having a beautiful face. That isn't enough. It's not a reason for living just so others can look at you. I want to be more than that," she said. "You already are," he said quietly.
I learned something from you when I was here 2 months ago. Your life gets all blown to bits the way ours did, or in some smaller way, and you have to put it all back together and find a reason for living when things change. I couldn't find that reason. You did. You found it here, and you had the guts to go looking for it. When I got back to London, I realized that maybe I had found it here too, and I didn't even see it. I came back to find out if the answer for me was here, and I missed it. Just like when you looked in the mirror after Brussels, all you saw were the scars. The scars aren't what it's about, or even the perfect face. It's about what's inside you and who you are. You're beautiful, Véronique, in all the ways that matter. Scars, no scars, it's irrelevant. Beauty is in the sunsets here, in the children, in the smiling faces, in the work they're doing here at St. Matthew's. It's in your eyes, and all the people who survived the hell we lived through. We survived. Maybe that's the whole point. And the real question is what we're going to do about it. I came back here to see you, he said honestly. He didn't want to play games with her or hide. I've never known anyone like you, not because of your face, but because of your heart. Your heart and the love in you balances out the hatred and the horror of what happened to us. I looked at you and I knew I was alive again, so here I am, he said softly, and reached for her hand. They held hands as they watched the sun go down and sink behind the African horizon. They had found peace in Angola, and a reason for living, and they had to find a way to take it home with them, keep the flame alive, and protect it against the forces of evil. She realized that that was what her father had been telling her, never to let that go or let the flame go out. Her mother had understood that better than she had. I know that if I didn't come back to see you and let the chance go by, I'd regret it forever. And I'd think about it one day when I'm old and be sorry, he smiled at her. So I'm here. My scars are on the inside and they're no prettier than yours. Yours are more honest because you can see them. You wear them like a badge of courage. I've been afraid to live again ever since that night in Paris. So have I, she admitted. I thought my life ended in Brussels. I wanted it to, but it didn't. Our punishment was that we had to live without them. We tried to bury ourselves too, you after Paris and me after Brussels. Thank you for coming back, she whispered to him, holding tightly to his hand. You were brave to come back. Thank you for being here, he smiled at her. They were both present and alive for the first time in over a year. They had found life again in Africa. She was ready to go home and start living again. No matter how scarred inside and out, she was still beautiful. She saw it in his eyes, and she believed him, just as he believed now that love had not died in Paris. It would come again. They had survived, and discovered in the end that life with all its beauty and tragedy and terror at times was worth living after all. Life is beautiful, and nothing could change that, scars and all. The End. This book was read for you by Nick Afker-Thomas, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Beautiful by Danielle Steele. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for listening to Recorded Books.